Anthony Reich, Shavua Tov, how are you?
Boker Tov, Shavua Tov. It's been quite a while since we last spoke. Pesach is over.
Yes.
We're through Mimuna, and we're into, I don't know, even though the days kind of feel like they're flowing one into the other, it seems like a very long time ago since we last had a chance to get updated, and so many things have been happening, not only on the political front and not only on the corona front, but also, you know, some things that we were used to talking about before all of this went on. Like, for example, there was a report coming out of Syria that there was an Israeli airstrike over the weekend that apparently targeted a jeep that had been traveling near to the Syria-Lebanon border, and that apparently an Israeli drone was used in order to target this. And that it might have targeted a Hezbollah commander who was even named, but they claim that this particular airstrike failed to hit him. There were some quite interesting pictures, some video footage that was published on TV that we had a chance to see. Very, very difficult to know exactly who and what and why, but some of these stories still coming out of the woodwork in spite of the fact that we seem to be almost exclusively focused on the whole corona issue.
It is interesting because we almost had this misconception that that whole side of life ceased for a while in Israel.
Yeah,
but I guess it's maybe
absolutely
just about the reporting more than it is anything else.
Exactly. I think a lot of it is just about, you know, not reaching the front pages of the newspaper to a large degree. I mean, also, you know, reports that we don't see in the papers but are there somewhere is that apparently Israel has actually loaned quite a lot of money to the Palestinian Authority in order to help them fight COVID-19. There have been reports that, you know, the Palestinian Authority could collapse as a result of this coronavirus pandemic, and that Israel is somehow trying to help support the Palestinian Authority to keep them alive. And of course, a lot of help also been going on in Gaza with Israel being involved in helping them to process tests that have been taken, some of the people in Gaza. So, you know, there have been a lot of things going on a more positive front, on a more cooperative front, which unfortunately get lost because of just the massive scale of this pandemic that we're dealing with right now.
So where is Israel in terms of the COVID fight?
Well, I mean, in terms of the numbers themselves, because the numbers are scary, the numbers are really scary. Israel has almost 15,000 people who have been diagnosed with coronavirus. It's a lot. It's a very, very large number indeed. And unfortunately, more than 170 people have died already, 172 to be precise, in terms of the latest numbers that I've seen. And the Israeli government has now taken to identifying hotspots where we find a larger than proportionate outbreak of the coronavirus, and they've effectively closed these places off. So we spoke last week about Bnei Brak being one of them, and we spoke about some of the suburbs of Jerusalem, but that's not where it ends. Some of the Arab towns and villages in the north were also found to be hotspots. Places like Deir al-Assad and places like Umm al-Fahim were found to be hotspots, and the Israeli army was ironically sent in to close off these Arab villages and to create an entire closure. And it was interesting to see how Arab members of Knesset were recruited to come along and to literally take a megaphone and to shout in the streets to the Arab citizens living in these towns and cities that they're in lockdown, that they're in closed down. Israeli police not allowing vehicles in and out of the Arab towns, soldiers on the streets of these Arab towns and villages distributing food and helping people to cope with the situation because of the fact that there was a greater than proportionate outbreak of COVID-19, of the coronavirus in those areas. Yesterday, the government announced that the lockdown on Bnei Brak and the suburbs of Jerusalem would be eased slightly. But up until now, it's kind of just been increasing numbers. And then we suddenly saw a slight change. And what we've seen is a slightly lower number of people now being diagnosed. So in the 24 hours that ended last night, because what happens is that the government, the Ministry of Health, are publishing figures twice a day, in the morning and the evening. So in the 24 hours that ended last night, 226 new infections were diagnosed of the coronavirus, and 8 people had died during that period as well, which in terms of the number of infections is a slightly lower number than we've seen up until now. Unfortunately, people are continuing to die, particularly weaker people in our society, and I don't think that we're going to see a dramatic reduction in the rate of that until such time as we reduce the number of people who are being diagnosed. But I think what the most positive thing is that we've seen from the numbers is that quite a dramatic reduction in the number of people who are being diagnosed as being in serious condition, and those people who are being intubated and on ventilation. So an 11% reduction day on day of the number of people who were in serious condition, and a 3.5% reduction in the number of people who are being intubated. Now, of course, unfortunately, some of those people have died in the meantime. Some of them have actually recovered and gone back the other way. Quite a large number of people are down as having already recovered from the virus, more than 3,500, almost 4,000 people having already recovered. So I think the numbers are starting to move in the right direction in terms of the raw statistics. And the Israeli government announced on Saturday night that they're beginning a very cautious and a very carefully orchestrated easing of the restrictions. So, for example, the announcement was that instead of only 15% of the workforce being allowed into the office, it's now being increased to 30%. And in fact, that 30% can be greater if certain conditions are met about how people work in the office. So, for example, if screens are erected between workers in an open space environment where they work close to each other, and if, you know, other conditions are met, then the office effectively could return all of the workers to work, but we still have very stringent social distancing measures in place. Masks now have to be worn when you go out in public. We are being forced to keep the 2-meter social distancing away. So there's very, very stringent still rules about social distancing that don't change. Certain shops have now been allowed to open up, dry cleaners, for example, and certain other shops that were previously closed. So a slow but sure return to some semblance of normality, to some semblance of economic activity, because, of course, if the government had a choice to keep people at home for another week or two or three, they would prefer to do that. But, of course, the economy is being so severely impacted by all of this that now economic considerations are really coming to the fore, and people are starting to say, you know, there's no point in staying home when the damage to the economy is so dramatic. And now is time for us to ease them up. The Prime Minister did warn on Saturday night when he made this announcement that if there was another outbreak, in other words, if there was a reversal of the positive trend of numbers, that he would close everything down again, that he would not hesitate to do it immediately. And so he has said, you know, as long as we stick to the conditions that have been laid down, that it should be okay. We're now allowed to venture up to 500 meters from home instead of the original 100 meters that was the restriction before. We're entitled to do a little bit of sport activity outside of the house. I'm not quite sure how that ties in with the masks, because we're still required to wear masks when we go out. So I'm not quite sure how we're expected to do sporting activity wearing masks. That's something I guess that will come out. But really, there's now just a slow but sure attempt to release the conditions and to ease things up a little bit.
Yeah, it's. I think every country is starting to have these same concerns now, because the most important thing was to shut it down and to stop the spread. But the economic implications are obviously enormous. We're seeing South Africa starting to also become just a little uncomfortable around it. We're seeing protests in the United States and in France. So it does seem that Israel at least is engaging very, very positively with these different aspects of it.
Well, they are trying to do whatever is possible, and I think that there's a real dilemma. I mean, obviously we see the arguments within the government between the Ministry of Finance and the Ministry of Health about what should be done. I mean, we've got this ongoing issue about what to do with the schools, for example. It's all fine and well to send the parents back to work, but parents can't be working while the children are still at home.
Right.
And so especially the young children, the children of kindergarten age and of primary school age, there's a lot of pressure now to get the schools back to work again.
Yeah.
There have been different proposals about exactly how to reintroduce schooling. So there's a lot of pressure on the schooling system, on the education ministry, to announce that the kids will go back to school, to allow the parents back to work. I think the problem is that there's so many people who've been put on furlough, leave without pay, not being at work, that people really don't know where they stand right now. Many people are expecting to go back having been on leave without pay to find that their job doesn't exist anymore. So people are in a very uncertain situation about what their future holds, and if people can get back to work and discover what the work situation is, whether their salaries have been reduced or whether they even have a job left, then I think it'll add a little bit more certainty to the economy. At the moment, people really don't know what to expect.
Yeah, very, very scary indeed. Holocaust Remembrance Day is marked in Israel and, in fact, around the world starting this evening. So what are the plans to mark this day given the current lockdown situation?
Zoom, I think, is the simple answer to the question. There's still no allowance for mass gatherings, or people getting together at all, which is, of course, the tradition on Holocaust Remembrance Day. That usually ceremonies in the evening that take place at Yad Vashem, ceremonies the following morning that take place in schools and its city centers around the country, and of course a siren that will sound tomorrow at 10 o'clock, the 2-minute siren to remember the 6 million who were killed in the Holocaust. And it's called not only Holocaust Remembrance Day, but of course Heroes, because there has been an attempt over the years to try to shift the opinion away from seeing those victims of the Holocaust purely as victims, but also to try to mark the heroism of those people, many of whom tried to fight back against, you know, all the odds. Some succeeded, most of them didn't. But I think what was interesting for me this time around is that there's been a focus on numbers. How many Jews exist in the world, and how does that compare to pre-Holocaust days? And what's interesting is that the last count, which was done approximately a year and a half ago, I think, as to the number of Jews in the world, came up with about 14.7 million Jews living in the world today. And that's still way below the number of Jews who lived in the world in the pre-Holocaust period, 1939. There were more than 16 million, almost 17 million Jews when counted up around the world. And so we're still more than 2 million people away from recovering the number of people who were killed in the Holocaust effectively. And when you go back to the last time that there were 14.7 million Jews in the world, you have to roll back to 1925, which is obviously before the Holocaust period, to find when last there was that number. So even though there's been this massive recovery, and of course the State of Israel has done a lot to encourage that, we're still not quite back to pre-Holocaust Day numbers in terms of the number of Jews around the world. And of course we always have this discussion about why Holocaust Day is marked now as opposed to in January, which is the International Holocaust Day. And I know we've discussed it before, but we'll talk a little bit about that tomorrow just as a teaser as to what the significance of this day is as opposed to other dates that were discussed indeed by the Israeli government. And interestingly, the fast of the 10th of Tevet, Asara B'Tevet, was the very, very first Holocaust Remembrance Day in 1949, when actually funerals were held to bury some of the bones and some of the ashes that were brought from.
Interesting.
So the Asara B'Tevet was the original first Holocaust Remembrance Day, and it was only, I think, in 1950 that the Israeli government decided on this date. And so the question that I'm going to pose and we'll answer tomorrow is, what is the significance of this period and this date for Holocaust Remembrance Day? But we'll have a chance to discuss that tomorrow. But in the meantime, what I would like to encourage people to do is to join in this evening at sundown, light a candle, think about you know, the good fortune that we have in spite of our lockdown situation, being Jews in the world today, and how we enjoy freedom, and how we have the real zchut, we have the privilege to be in a situation that we're in today, as opposed to, unfortunately, those of our forefathers, our ancestors, who didn't quite have this privilege. So let's join in as a nation together, everybody. Let's just light a candle to remember those people. And, of course, tomorrow we'll continue to talk a little bit more about that.
Anthony Raff, thank you, as always. And we will be chatting to Mary Klook a little bit later to hear what the commemorations will look like here in South Africa. Tomorrow's show, of course, will be dedicated to the to Holocaust Memorial Day. Anthony Raff, we'll catch you tomorrow. Thank you, as always. It's just gone 8 o'clock. I'm Howard Feldman. A very good morning.